Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 4, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Our discussion is today is going to be the oral argument in King versus Burwell, the case that is all about state versus federally established health care exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back today a repeat guest to Teleform, Professor Jonathan H. Adler. He's the Johann Verhey Memorial Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. He's also widely recognized as the architect of the legal theory under which today's litigation has been proceeding. We've had him on Teleform before for this case and other cases, but we're very pleased to welcome him back. He's going to give us opening remarks discussing some of the history procedurally of the case, then culminating in his discussion of what transpired today at oral argument, but then, as always, taking questions from you, the audience members. So please do be ready with those questions when we get to that portion of the call. With that, Professor Adler, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about King versus Burwell, the third case heard by the Supreme Court concerning the Affordable Care Act since that law's passage. As I think everyone knows, the court initially heard a frontal constitutional challenge to the Affordable Care Act in NFIB versus Sebelius, in which the court upheld the penalty of the individual mandate as a tax, but held that the mandate could not be justified under the commerce power and that new Medicaid money could not be constitutionally conditioned, old Medicaid money could not be constitutionally conditioned on the acceptance of the new Medicaid expansion. The court considered the Affordable Care Act again in the Hobby Lobby case, where it looked at how the implementation of that law intersected with statutes that provide for the protection of religious exercise and religious freedom. And then today we have the Affordable Care Act's third trip to the Supreme Court, in which the court is looking at how the IRS is implementing provisions of the statute that concern the operation of exchanges in which consumers in the individual market may purchase health insurance. The key issue in the case is whether or not the IRS acted consistent with the law when it issued a regulation saying that individuals who purchase qualifying health insurance in exchanges established by the federal government may receive tax credits under the Act. The reason this is a legal issue is because the relevant provision of the law in Section 1401 authorizes tax credits for the purchase of qualifying health insurance in an exchange established by the state under Section 1311. The IRS's position is that even though the language of the statutory provision says established by a state under Section 1311, that an exchange established by the Department of Health and Human Services under Section 1321 qualifies and can be the locus of a health insurance purchase that is eligible for tax credits. This is an issue that has divided lower courts. This case is an appeal from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, which had held that the statute is sufficiently ambiguous that it would defer to the IRS's interpretation and thereby upheld the rule. On the same day as that decision had come out, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit had held the opposite. It held that the IRS rule was impermissible under the law because the statute only authorizes tax credits for the purchases of health insurance in an exchange established by the state, and the Department of Health and Human Services is not a state. State, incidentally, is defined in the statute as one of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. There were also cases filed in district courts, and one of those in Oklahoma did reach a final judgment, and there the district court in Oklahoma agreed with the D.C. Circuit, holding that the IRS rule was unconstitutional. The D.C. Circuit decision was subject to a petition for en banc rehearing from the federal government that was initially granted. Rather than wait for the disposition of that, the plaintiffs in the Virginia litigation, filed a petition for certiorari in that case, which the court accepted. And so that was the case that was argued today. I should say at the outset, in terms of the oral argument today, the justices were very attentive and engaged in the oral argument. You could certainly see that they were listening very carefully to the questions at issue. It was a fairly active bench, a lot of justices asking quite a few questions. Initially, right off the bat, Justice Ginsburg raised questions about standing. This is something that had gotten a lot of attention in the press, whether or not one or more of the plaintiffs in the case had taken actions or had changes in their lives that would mean they no longer had standing to bring this case. That's an important question, because if no plaintiff has standing, then the court will be deprived of Article III jurisdiction. That really didn't seem to go very far. Michael Carvin, who was arguing for the plaintiffs, explained why explained, as we know, that only one of the plaintiffs needs to have standing for there to be jurisdiction, and explained why at least two of the plaintiffs would still have standing under the theories of standing that had been recognized by the lower courts. The Solicitor General did not really dispute that, asked to address standing at the beginning of his argument. Don Varelli pretty much just laid out what the relevant legal tests would be and what factual showings would need to be made, but also said that he had heard nothing from the plaintiffs that would make him believe that the court lacked jurisdiction, and so his assumption was that they had standing in the court. Had jurisdiction, and the Solicitor General's office really did not take the opportunity to pursue that line of argument, suggesting, I think, that they realize that's not a basis upon which they could win, and that it's almost certain that at least one of the four plaintiffs has standing. In terms of the substance, Michael Carvin was certainly challenged quite a bit on statutory language. Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan were very aggressive. But I think he ably held his own, and it did not seem that any of the conservative justices or either of the justices who were potential swing justices, that being the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy, it did not seem that either of them were particularly persuaded by the textual arguments made on the government's behalf. The Solicitor General, for his part, was asked to explain why the language of the statute reads as it does. Why does it say established by the state instead of established in the state or for the state, or perhaps just to simply say exchange, generic reference to exchange? And he didn't really have a good argument for why that would be, about why Congress would adopt this awkward phrasing. And even at one point, I think, misstated the drafting history of the language in question, suggesting that this language is really language that completely dated from the Senate Finance Committee, whereas we know that one of the references to exchanges established by the state in the relevant provision was added very late in the process under a lot of time pressure in the Senate Majority Leader's office, and that's discussed in the amicus brief that I submitted along with Michael Cannon, discussing some of our research on this case. On questions of whether or not the statute was potentially ambiguous, there were some interesting questions about that. The reason this matters is because if the court were to conclude that the statutory language is ambiguous, then we would normally think that this would mean that the court should defer to the agency's interpretation, provided that interpretation is reasonable. What's interesting is that Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts both expressed some skepticism about both whether there's ambiguity but more importantly, what the implications of that would be. Justice Kennedy asked whether a conflict within the statute itself should be seen as a source of ambiguity. The Solicitor General said yes, but it is worth noting that last term, in a case in which the court was confronted with that question, a majority of the justices concluded that conflict in statutory provisions would not be was not ambiguity for purposes of Chevron, because it would not be evidence that Congress meant to delegate the interpretive question to the agency. And Chief Justice Justice Kennedy responded as well that he thought it would be, in his words, a drastic step to conclude that Congress had delegated something as momentous as whether or not tax credits would exist in federal exchanges to the IRS. That is the sort of thing that Congress would not just lied over. That would be the sort of thing that, that Congress would have been clear about. And the Chief Justice then asked whether or not, if the court were to decide at Chevron Step 2, would that not mean that a future administration could reverse course? And of course, the answer to that is yes. The court's precedent is quite clear that agencies may change their interpretations of statutes under Chevron Step 2 over time, and that they may change their interpretations with changes in administration. One issue that's a wild card in this litigation, and it's one that, that has started to get a lot of press and is addressed quite a bit by amicus briefs, but not nearly so much by the merits brief by the plaintiffs or the government, is how federalism concerns should influence the interpretation of the statute. There was a lot of interest in this. It was raised early on by Justice Sotomayor, for example, and a lot of people think that federalism concerns are a possible way that either Justice Kennedy and or the Chief Justice might be convinced to side with the federal government. A couple observations about that. One, as those federalism arguments got explicated in the argument, I think it became clear that for the court to conclude that conditioning the availability of tax credits on state cooperation raises problematic federalism concerns, the court would have to implicitly or explicitly shift federalism doctrine quite dramatically, because the court has upheld statutes under which Congress has imposed quite serious consequences on private parties in uncooperating states. And the court has had no problem upholding such arrangements in the past. So to suggest that the plaintiff's interpretation of the statute here is problematic would certainly shift the doctrine in that direction. Justice Alito also pointed out on the question of notice, that is whether or not federalism requires that states are put on adequate notice of the conditions in a statute, that the way these provisions work is that insofar as states didn't have notice, it's because of the IRS rule, but that were the court to side with the plaintiffs, states would then have the chance, and that what the notice requirement is about is making sure that states understand the conditions they are accepting when they make their choice. And Justice Alito, I think, ably illustrated why there's no problem here. If the court were to side with the plaintiffs, states would have the opportunity to decide whether or not they want to create exchanges, and they would know what the conditions were of that choice. And I think that addressed that concern. One other issue that came up, which is also not discussed all that much in the briefing, is related to remedy. Justice Alito raised the question of whether or not the court could, for example, stay the mandate until the end of the year to make clear that any decision would not take effect until the next tax year, to allow for an easier transition, to allow for states to make a choice about whether or not to create exchanges. Justice Alito pointed out that the court had done that before, and the Solicitor General really had no objection to that or argument to that. The Solicitor General noted that the situation here is arguably slightly different because federal expenditures are involved, but certainly noted that the court could do that, and that something like that would ease the transition. So I think that was also interesting, particularly because the briefing by the parties really did not focus very much on remedy questions. So those are some observations from the oral argument, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions that folks might have.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our professor, Jonathan Adler, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a few people on the phone. It looks like we've got four or five questions to get us started. So I'm going to ask the callers to be as concise as possible with their questions so we can get to as many of our callers as possible. Before we go to the first caller, let me make a quick programming announcement about our upcoming schedule tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll recap a recently issued Yates decision. That's the Sarbanes-Oxley case, why is a fish not a tangible object, that was recently decided. And we will be discussing that tomorrow at 2 p.m. Then on Friday, Teleforum, also at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, our topic will be cybersecurity and the new book, At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Today, of course, Jonathan Adler and King versus Burwell. Let's go to our first audience question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. In reading the passage at issue and other passages in the same act, and from review of other legislation in its early drafting stages, I simply don't find the case here of being a drafting error. I think it was intentional. Instant, clearly it was in context, but it is a miscalculation. In other words, it was an attempt to put pressure on the people of states to in turn put pressure on their state governments to participate in the program. Now, this is would be an example of one of Cass Sunstein's nudges. But nudges only work if they're small and operate over a period of decades. And in this case, they tried to nudge the people and the states too much to act over too short a period of time for any such incentive to work as intended. So I think we have to recognize that this was a miscalculation that deserves to be recognized as such, and the consequences endured by the perpetrators of it. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree. That's certainly the argument, an argument that Michael Cannon and I have made in our writing on the subject. We've pointed out how the drafting history of these provisions do not suggest that this was an error, and also do not suggest that the statutory provisions at issue mean anything other than what they plainly say. And something that's a useful exercise that people might want to engage in is, you know, if you look at Section 1401 and you read the language saying that purchases for which there will be tax credits are those made in an exchange established by the state under Section 1311, that's clear language. I submit that any member of Congress who read that sentence would understand what it means, would know what the word established means, know what established by means, knows what state means, might have even noticed that the word state is actually defined in the statute as one of the 50 states or the District of Columbia. And if you were to compare that, for example, with the provisions in the statute concerning Medicaid, the inducement to state cooperation in the Medicaid provisions is never explicit in the Affordable Care Act. Rather, it was accomplished by merely amending participation requirements that already existed in the U.S. Code. So someone who had read those portions of the Affordable Care Act would only understand what Congress was doing if they were aware of the pre-existing provisions in the U.S. Code or bothered to look them up when they were reading the statute. And so by the standards that we usually impose on statutes, I think it's hard to argue that this condition is any less clear or less understandable than the sorts which courts deal with all the time.
Very good. We've still got time for several questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yes, apropos of the previous question, I'm wondering if Jonathan Gruber's name was mentioned during this morning's argument.
It was not. You know, I think the relevance of the Gruber quotes, and it's worth noting that there were more than one, is really not as to the original meaning of the statutory language, but whether or not the idea that this language could be used to induce state cooperation was something that was merely invented as opposed to something that was understood as a plausible interpretation. And I think it shows the latter, but no, it did not come up. There was certainly discussion in the oral argument about whether or not the court has to read a statute in a way that avoids untoward consequences or things that Congress might not have foreseen, and Justice Scalia in particular stressed repeatedly what I think is absolutely correct, which is that it's not the court's job to fix problems that Congress might have avoided if it had had the benefit of hindsight. The court can't assume that every statute that Congress enacts necessarily achieves everything that Congress wanted to achieve. What matters really is what Congress said and what Congress passed into law.
Jonathan, this is Dean. Was there, following on Scalia's comment that you just mentioned, was there any discussion then of the ability and the history of Congress in the face of a Supreme Court decision going back and fixing a problem that the court had identified? Was there discussion of that?
Scalia, asked the Solicitor General about, don't we assume usually that if there's a problem with our decision that Congress can fix it, and doesn't Congress all the time make revisions to statutes after we've interpreted them? And the SG tried to be cute by suggesting, well, maybe not this Congress. And that got some laughs in the courtroom. The idea did come up that, that if Congress doesn't like the way a statute has been interpreted or doesn't like the way a statute is operating in practice, that Congress remains fully able to make amendments or revisions if that is what Congress desires to do.
Very good. Let's take another question from the audience.
Yes, Professor Adler. My name is Mark Gibson. I'm a retired Army officer and member of the Federalist Society out here in Texas. First thing I want to say is that I would like to see a ruling that holds that the language of the law is unambiguous, and they would rule in favor of the plaintiffs, that being a win against executive agencies trying to legislate rather than execute laws. Having said all that, I would be interested in hearing your opinion regarding if we assume for a moment that the court chooses to view the term state narrowly as meaning one of the 50, how much influence do you think would be upon the decision concerning the far-reaching significance of ruling against the IRS? And, you would have a lot of people out there that are affected. And I just wondered your opinion as to how much that is actually taken into consideration when they consider things like this.
The court, the term state is actually defined in the statute. And generally, the court assumes that if Congress goes through the trouble of defining a term, that is what the term means for purposes of the law, and state is expressly defined as one of the 50 states or District of Columbia. And it was noted in oral argument that the statute does not contain equivalency language saying that the federal government may be treated as a state. But does, for example, contain language, such equivalency language, for the purpose of, for provisions involving the status of federal territories. In terms of the consequences, two things. One is, there was some concern by some of the justices, including Justice Kennedy, about a statutory structure that would impose restrictions or penalties on private individuals as a consequence of a lack of state cooperation. But I think that's something that, as the justices reflect upon, they will realize that they've upheld that in other contexts, and that certainly in a lot of conditional spending statutes, like with Medicaid, the court has upheld conditioning substantial sums that are for the benefit of vulnerable populations on the cooperation. The last thing is in terms of effects, Justice Alito did raise the issue of whether the court could stay its mandate to provide for a transitional period. And the Solicitor General acknowledged that doing something like that would, in fact, make it easier to comply and would address some of the transitional concerns. The Solicitor General questioned whether or not that would be enough, whether there would be enough time for states to actually create their own exchanges. but did acknowledge that it would reduce the disruption of a decision for the plaintiff, and acknowledge that there is precedent for the court doing something like staying its mandate.
Right, and I'm sure they know that the lawmakers are considering stopgap measures as well. I wonder how much that influences their thought processes.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, that issue certainly came up. Whether or not that'll actually influence them or not, it's hard to know.
Yeah, who knows, right? Well, I appreciate it, sir.
Professor Adler, I wasn't sure I heard you correctly. Did you say the issue of possible stopgap measures by the legislature did come up at the argument?
Well, the argument that Congress could respond if Congress didn't like the outcome came up, and Justice Scalia, noted that's happened before. Noted that's happened in the context of, for example, bankruptcy law provisions, which is also a context in which the court has issued a stay on the mandate before. So, and some of you may even be familiar, there's a famous back and forth between Justice Scalia and Justice Stevens from an opinion quite some time ago, in which Justice Scalia made the argument in that case that insofar as Congress is unhappy with the court's interpretation, Congress always remains at liberty to revise the statute, and that it certainly would be able to do so here.
But there was no discussion of actual pending
proposals
that have been drafted.
Proposals. Just a notion that that Congress retains the ability to make changes if that's something that Congress thinks is a problem.
Terrific.
And Justice Scalia put it in terms of if the consequences of a ruling for the plaintiff are really as disastrous as the government suggests, then isn't that more reason to expect Congress to act?
If you have a question, if you're in our audience, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got a few questions pending, so let's take another call.
Hey, John. It's John Shepherd from Skadden calling. It's nice to talk to an old friend on the phone. I'm a little bit mystified about this stay the mandate question. There's a pending case where we're on the defense, and it's pending on certiorari right now. It's called EPSA v. FERC, and this stay kind of solution has come up. And so I've been in this area recently, and I'm looking right now at Rivers versus Redway Express, Harper versus Virginia Department of Taxation, James B. Distilling, Reynoldsville Casket versus Hyde, and here's a brief excerpt. A judicial construction of the statute is an authoritative statement of what the statute meant before as well as after the decision of the case, giving rise to that construction. Here's another one. When this court applies a rule of federal law to the parties before it, that rule is controlling interpretation of federal law and must be given full retroactive effect in all cases still open or on direct review, and as to all events, regardless of whether such events predate or postdate the announcement of the rule. So I could go on, but I think you get the point. What I'm not familiar with this bankruptcy case that you're talking about, but how would staying the mandate actually change the application of the law? And this the other reason why this seems confusing is here they would be potentially reversing the Fourth Circuit, or they wouldn't be worrying about staying the mandate. But you've still got authoritative statements by the D.C. Circuit and another one holding contrary to the Fourth Circuit, so you could at least rewind back to that. I'm just confused. Can you elaborate, please?
First, John, it's good to hear from you. Look, I think there is reason to wonder about precisely how all this works, and it's generally not something that was really covered in the briefing. It came up today when Justice Alito asked the Solicitor General whether or not, for example, the court could side with the petitioners and stay the mandate until the end of the tax year, and noted that this has been done in cases like Northern Pipeline to avoid potentially disruptive consequences. And I think part of the rationale for doing something like that here, I think, is twofold. One is, insofar as the law was violated, it was violated by the IRS, but the people who are potentially harmed or displaced by a ruling are the individual taxpayers who have made decisions about what type of insurance to purchase based on the IRS's assurances. And it's been noted in the press, for example, that the federal government has been willing to accommodate the concerns of insurers by modifying contract provisions to account for what would happen if the plaintiffs won here, but has not given any sort of warning to individual taxpayers that the tax credits they are relying upon are legally contested. So one reason why the court might think this is the sort of unusual case in which it merits an exercise of the court's essentially discretionary equitable authority to stay the mandate would be because the harms of the disruption are on the taxpayers, but the violation, the act that is being struck down was that of the IRS, and so it's a way to hold those individuals harmless. It's essentially a way to give states the opportunity to make the decision that the statute initially anticipated, which is to make a choice about whether or not to create an exchange, and thereby both providing tax credits to citizens while simultaneously exposing employers to the employer mandate penalty and some individuals to individual mandate penalties. The other thing that's just interesting about the statute is that tax credits are the availability of tax credits is determined on a month-by-month basis. And so that means that if the mandate were not stayed, that potentially this could change the position of taxpayers as of July, or July 1 or August 1. I think the court just recognizes that that's a somewhat unusual scenario. But you're certainly correct that there are not a lot of cases in which the court has done something like this. The closest analog that I could think of beyond cases like Northern Pipeline is the practice that the D.C. Circuit sometimes adopts, and it's a controversial practice, of occasionally simultaneously holding an agency rule to be unlawful under the APA, but also remanding it to the agency without vacator. And as I know some of the judges on the D.C. Circuit think that that is completely improper under the Administrative Procedure Act. I share that view. But we also know that the D.C. Circuit has made a practice of occasionally doing that, either to give the agency an opportunity to cure the infirmity or to potentially involve or potentially prevent disruption. And so, this is a long way of saying that when it comes to some of these remedy questions, we don't have as many clear guides as we might like. And as a consequence, the court does seem to have some discretion.
I'd be happy to follow up you later about remedies, but that puts the cart before the horse. What was your overall view on where the merits are likely to come out?
I've always felt that this was a difficult case, not because I think it's difficult on the merits. I think the text of the statute is very plain, and have felt that way since first reading the statute over 3 years ago. But generally, and certainly what I teach my students is that when you challenge the federal government and when you are seeking to have a federal regulation invalidated, it's a lot like betting against the house in a casino. And so you kind of have to go in knowing that the odds are against you. I've also always felt that the federalism arguments, if they were made, would be something of a wild card because they would appeal to some of the justices that are also most likely to be sympathetic to strict textual arguments. So I feel coming out of this very much the way I did coming in. I think that it's hard from the oral argument. It's hard to see how the federal government could get a majority purely on the textual question. The court did not seem particularly sympathetic. Justice Kennedy, even when raising some of the federalism issues, was at pains to say repeatedly that the text may foreclose all of this, and the text may just say, hey, text is what it is. And he certainly seemed unpersuaded by the explanations that the government gave as to why the statute would be written the way it is. But it is certainly possible that Justice Kennedy or Chief Justice Roberts might think that the federalism concerns justify stretching the language of the statute But I think if the court were to do so, there would be a bit of win the battle, lose the war for the federal government, because there are a wide number of cases out there and being contemplated in which challenges to existing federal programs would be significantly strengthened by such a federalism holding. And those cases range from Mayhew versus Burwell, which is a pending cert petition filed by the state of Maine concerning the conditions placed on receipt of Medicaid funding under the Affordable Care Act, include cases potentially involving No Child Left Behind and the Clean Air Act, and could even implicate the current challenges to what the Environmental Protection Agency is proposing to do under Section 111 of the Clean Air Act, where the EPA is saying to states something that's quite parallel to what some amici here suggested is constitutionally problematic. They are saying to states, regulate for us, do our dirty work, or we're going to have to come in and regulate in a much harsher, much dirtier, much more painful way. Well, you know, that's the sort of thing that some of the amici suggested would raise constitutional concerns in this case. So if the federal government were to win on those grounds, I think there'd be a lot in the opinion that proponents of state flexibility would find quite amenable. But, of course, we'll have to see what they actually do.
Well, Roger that, and thanks for your time. I wish I didn't have to give clients the same advice you give your students about betting against folks. Appreciate it, John. Bye.
Jonathan and Steen, you've mentioned a couple times the amici briefs on the federalism issue. I just want to be clear, how much of the government's case revolved around the federalism issue? And when – go right ahead.
Yes, the federal government has said very little about these issues. In the federal government's brief itself, there is a nod to the argument that states need to be on clear notice. But really nothing more than that. Similarly, here, the Solicitor General, anytime the federalism arguments came up, essentially said, well, I'm not willing to say that this would be unconstitutional. In fact, the Solicitor General said that were the court to side with the plaintiffs and were a constitutional question raised, Varelli said point blank that he believed he could successfully defend such conditions under existing doctrine, and then kept trying to shift back to the text, essentially arguing, well, if you're worried about these federalism concerns, then that's just a reason to interpret the statute this way. The arguments, though, that were being hinted at were raised in three separate briefs, one focusing on the notice argument, filed by the state of Virginia, second filed by some legal academics, talking about how a statute should be construed to avoid disruptions of the traditional federal-state balance, and then a third brief that went so far as to suggest that conditioning subsidies on state cooperation would actually be unconstitutionally coercive. And as I said, I think the federal government is well aware that were it to accept these arguments, it would strengthen the hand of those who are challenging other conditions placed on Medicaid funding, challenging some of the conditions that are imposed and consequences that are imposed under the Clean Air Act, and potentially even strengthen the hand of those who would challenge some of the requirements that the Department of Education has sought to impose under the No Child Left Behind law. So, so they're interesting arguments, but they are high-risk arguments for the government. Because while they could possibly help the government in this case, they could hurt in other cases. One other point on the federalism arguments I should note is there are a few briefs. I know Boyd and Gray submitted one. There's another brief, some other briefs submitted by states in support of the petitioners that make the point that a real concern for federalism should manifest itself in the court upholding the choice that Congress gave to the states. So states like Indiana and Oklahoma have argued that the statute gives states a choice. It basically says you can participate or not. Congress may have assumed that all 50 states would participate, but it did give them a choice. And just as states had to have a choice under Medicaid, they have to have a choice here, and that choice should be preserved. And Justice Alito noted, I thought this was quite interesting, that of the 34 states that did not create their own exchanges, only six of them are on a brief saying that the government should prevail. That is to say, the vast majority of states that failed to create their own exchanges and that would lose tax credits should the plaintiffs prevail and they choose not to create an exchange, vast majority of states in that position have not come to the support of the federal government, and that is certainly interesting if one is concerned about the impact on states from a decision here.
We've still got quite a few questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Professor Adler, thanks very much. J.D. with Aon Hewitt. My question relates again to the textual argument. If the government loses on the textual argument, how much leeway is there on the part of the Supreme Court to do what they did in the Medicaid portion of the NFIB case in 2012, basically rewrite the statute as they did in 2012, say you only lose a portion of the funding, which was never in the statute? Is it possible that they would simply require that federal subsidies be paid? I know that sounds a little outlandish, but again, the Medicaid case in 2012, they basically rewrote the statute there. Is there leeway for them to do that in this case?
I mean, I certainly wouldn't expect an opinion along those lines. I do think it's possible the court could say something like the following, that, you know, reading the statute, applying the traditional tools of statutory interpretation, the plaintiffs have the stronger argument. However, this would raise federalism concerns. Therefore, we will go beyond the text of the statute and read the statute in a way so as to eliminate those concerns and then essentially hand the victory to the federal government. I mean, I think that's certainly a possible way for the government to win. In fact, based on the oral argument, if the government wins, I think that is the most likely way that they win. I did not see much interest on the court in siding for the government at Chevron Step 2, and I certainly did not see anyone but the most liberal justices express much sympathy for the government's basic textual argument. And I think at some points, for example, you know, Justice Breyer put forward a potential textual interpretation that is really hard to square with what the text actually says, among other things, characterizing as a definition, a provision in the statute, which is clearly labeled as, written as, and operates as a requirement rather than a definition. So that's certainly possible. The court would do that. And, you know, I think if the court does that, what the result would be something a lot like what we saw perhaps in United States versus Bond, which while it might do violence to the text of the statute and to traditional notions of how statutes should be interpreted, I think it would bolster the hands of state governments and folks who are concerned about the federal government's ability to induce state cooperation in future cases. And you know, I think that result would be to some degree a good thing, because the federal government certainly has quite a bit of ability to pressure states. And if the government were to win at the expense of losing some ability to induce state cooperation, that would be quite a silver lining on the cloud of a loss in the case.
And one quick follow-up, was there any discussion of the additional protections that state insurance markets have under the Affordable Care Act to prevent the death spiral, such as risk corridors, readjustments, and risk sharing along those lines?
There really wasn't. And there is an amicus brief filed on the plaintiff's behalf that talks about that, and also talks about how the death spiral sorts of concerns actually take a while to manifest themselves. They don't appear the day after a decision or the day after requirements are imposed. That did not really get a lot of attention, although Justice Scalia did note that, you know, insofar as the government is predicting dire consequences from a victory by the plaintiffs, the more dire the consequences, the more likely it is that the political branches and or states would respond, so that those sorts of things are essentially self-correcting. The greater the consequences, the less the court has to worry about whether or not the Congress might fix it.
Thank you.
Professor Adler, Pepper Crutcher down here in Mississippi at Balch and Bingham, acareview.com. You've answered every one of the federal questions I had except this one. we had a kerfuffle within the Republican Party here in Mississippi between our insurance commissioner and our governor over precisely the question raised by this appeal. Did anybody in the argument, either on the bench or among counsel, talk about such disputes within states that decided not to create their own exchange?
Not that I recall. I mean, the question of notice was raised. As I mentioned, that's the part of the federalism concerns that the Solicitor General is most willing to embrace. It is worth noting, though, that insofar as those questions came up, Justice Alito in particular pointed out that notice is typically concerned. We're typically worried about conditions that states discover after they've made their choice. Right? They enter a federal program and then suddenly they're told the next day they have to do a bunch of things they weren't aware of, and that's not the case here, and that should the court side with the petitioners, that wouldn't be the case because states would have the ability to make their choice fully aware of the consequences. Beyond that, though, there really wasn't much discussion of what actually happened within state legislatures, whether states did actually have notice. The Solicitor General did make what I thought was a somewhat curious argument to say that when one looks at the docket of comments that were filed when the IRS rule was originally proposed, some of the states that are on the petitioner's side raised concerns about the IRS rule but did not raise this particular concern. You know, I'm not really sure why that matters. As you know, anyone who practices in the administrative law area knows, you don't, to preserve an issue for litigation, you don't have to be the one to file those comments. It just has to be in the record. And certainly plenty of folks did raise this concern in the rulemaking record. And the fact that states raised other questions when filing comments doesn't particularly matter. And that's especially true since one of the states that the Solicitor General mentioned was the state of Oklahoma, which filed suit against this IRS rule before the deadline for deciding whether or not to create an exchange. And so that's pretty clear that states could have been on notice and in many cases were on notice and, in fact, were objecting to this even before they had to make a choice.
We've got three questions pending. Let's take another call.
Professor, it's David Tryon in Cleveland. And you've answered all my questions, so maybe I can just make an observation. Several years ago, when you made your presentation to the Cleveland chapter of the Federal Society about this, it was, it seemed completely right to me. But I heard other people who subsequently commented on your position that it was a ridiculous argument and it would go nowhere. And so just congratulations on getting this far. And furthermore, even if no matter which way this turns out, if nothing else, right now there's some people in the administration sweating pretty hard, and so that's worth something. Even if your argument ultimately loses, but I think it will prevail. And so, good luck, and thanks.
Well, thank you, David, and hopefully I'll be back in Cleveland by tonight. I just make one comment on that one, just about the nature of the argument, and certainly the nature of the argument over this case in academia. One conspicuous difference in the way statutes are approached in courts versus the way they are approached in the academy is that the current Supreme Court and most federal courts are quite textualist in their orientation, far more so than they were, say, 30 or 40 years ago. Academics, on the other hand, are often quite skeptical of textualism and much more enamored of what we might call purposivism or intentionalism, or kind of the sort of pragmatist interpretation endorsed by folks like Richard Posner. And what I think has happened in a lot of the debates over this case is there are a lot of people that would like to say, who cares about the precise semantic meaning of the individual words? We all know Congress is trying to solve this problem and expand health coverage. Let's just make sure that that's how the statute operates. That's an argument actually in the academy that many people would endorse. The problem is that's not the sort of argument that more than two or three justices on the current court would endorse. And so there's been this phenomenon where people who really want to make non-textual arguments feel they have to make textual arguments, And real contextual arguments that they make aren't all that strong, but their position about the case remains strong because at the end of the day, they'd be deciding on other grounds. And so I think that explains some of the vehemence with which some commentators explain the federal government must be right. It's not because they're evaluating the federal government's textualist arguments. It's because they believe in their heart of hearts that strict textualism is not the way the court should resolve this sort of case.
We've got
thanks for the explanation.
Four questions pending now. We've got some folks ringing in late. Let's try and get through as many of these as possible.
All right, I'll be quick now.
Go ahead, Colin.
Hi, Professor Adler. Thanks for the discussion. And you kind of alluded to this already, and this might be a little bit too obvious. It's often difficult to predict from oral argument how the court might come out. But, I mean, is this from your sense of the oral argument, are we looking at something 5-4? Or, I mean, in 2012, we had 7-2 on the Medicaid expansion, which I think was a little bit more lopsided than some people thought they might see on that question. Do you have a sense of that, or kind of want to plead the fifth, not take a position? What do you think?
Well, I'm not going to make a prediction. I mean, I'm obviously very close to this case, and I'm obviously convinced by my own arguments. And, you know, there is a tendency to think that the arguments you believe will prevail. I think based on the oral argument that, Justice Kennedy and perhaps Chief Justice Roberts, who I should note was noticeably quiet. The Chief Justice did not ask a lot of questions. I think those two justices are the justices that people thought going in might be in play. I think that oral argument confirms that they both might be in play. Now, the only prediction I would make is that if the federal government wins, I think it's likely to be in part due to the federalism argument. I did not see any indication that Justice Kennedy or the Chief Justice was persuaded by the textualist arguments that the Solicitor General tried to make. Does that mean? It means the federal government could win 5-4 or 6-3. It means that the plaintiffs could win 5-4. I also saw nothing in the argument that suggested any of the liberal justices might side with the plaintiffs. I would assume that all four of those justices are firmly in the government's camp. And I would note, you know, last term, those four justices all sided with the EPA in the Utility Air Regulatory Group case and said that EPA could rewrite the term 250 tons per year to be 100,000 tons per year. And, you know, any justice that was willing to allow that sort of statutory interpretation isn't going to find established by the state to be that much of an obstacle.
Right.
Well, Jonathan, as if by magic, we still have four questions pending. We've got a few minutes left. Let's go to the next
one. That's a hybrid. Want to replace it itself.
Yeah, I know the chief was, you said silent. You said that a couple times or noticeably quiet. He added 10 minutes to each side of the argument and then apparently didn't use any of that time to inject himself any further. But let's take another question from the audience. The caller, you might have your phone on mute if you've got your phone.
Oh, hi, it's Lee Otis. I didn't hear the very end of your sentence, Dean, and therefore wasn't sure if you'd asked a question. Given the non-centrality of the federalism arguments to the parties' briefs, is there any possibility that there might be a request by the court for a supplemental briefing on that question and or the remedy question?
It's possible. I didn't see any indication that they were necessarily interested in that. So that would surprise me, but based on what we heard, it's always possible.
All right. Let's take another call.
Hi. Yeah. I have a question on the significance of the word such preceding exchange, where it says the federal government shall establish such exchange. Does that give them any authority to really be stepping in as if they were the state and therefore the subsidies would be valid?
That's one of the textual arguments the government tries to make, and it's one that I think is problematic, and I think why it's problematic came up in oral argument, there was a hypothetical initially proposed by Justice Kagan about her law clerks that was trying to deal with that, and I think it was effectively parried both by Mike Carvin and by Justice Alito. And I think the way to understand that is that when the statute says such exchange, it is telling the federal government what type of exchange to create in terms of what the functions and operation of that exchange are. But the relevant provision in Section 1401 in specifying that tax credits are only available in an exchange both specifies that the exchange must be a Section 1311 exchange in terms of its functionality, but also that it must be established by the state. That is, Section 1401 references both the what and the who, the what being the type of exchange, the who being who created it. And the word such in 1321 can overcome the what prong, or can accommodate that, but has a difficulty with the who, because Section 1321 says expressly that it is the Secretary of Health and Human Services that is establishing the exchange, and in fact uses that word. And Justice Kennedy in particular seemed to be quite perplexed with the idea that the language in the statute could mean what the Solicitor General was arguing, and perplexed at the idea that a Congress wanting to indicate that a federal exchange is for all purposes the same as a state exchange would have used this language to do so. And I would just add finally, contrary to what a lot of pundits have suggested, the Solicitor General in no way suggested there was any sort of drafting error or typo in the statute. In fact, went out of his way to argue the contrary, even at the expense of slightly misstating the relevant drafting history. So I think that's an argument that is unlikely to convince the majority of the court.
Great, thanks.
We've got time for a final question. We just have one question pending, so this is working out nicely.
Hi, this is George May with Toomey May in Houston, Texas. I have a forward-looking question that has some assumptions. Let's assume that the court does side with the plaintiffs, and then subsequently either the Democrats in the Senate or Congress itself can't get anything out, or the president vetoes it, and there's never a fix to the problem. Does that raise any potential causes of action for plaintiffs in the future to overturn the entire Affordable Care Act?
I doubt that. That is to say, I think that would be hard to do in terms of these specifics, and I'm not sure what such a challenge would look like. I think that that if the government prevails, if plaintiffs prevail and Congress doesn't act, the action would really shift to the state level, and the question would be whether or not state legislatures decide to try and create their own exchanges, and whether or not the Department of Health and Human Services would take any steps to try and ease that transition or facilitate the state creation of exchanges. The department has thus far said they have no such plans in place, but there are steps that the federal government could take if it wanted to make it easier for states to create exchanges. And I think if the plaintiffs win and Congress does not respond, I think that's what we'd be looking at. And those battles would be fought out primarily in state legislatures. I don't quite see how it could be used to bootstrap a new facial challenge to the statute as a whole. And I think going forward, additional Affordable Care Act litigation, of which there will be plenty. There's a cert petition pending right now from the state of Maine about Medicaid conditions. There's a lawsuit just filed by the state of Ohio on taxes and fees imposed to support a reinsurance fund. There will be more suits. These will all be suits challenging the implementation of specific provisions, the application of certain provisions to specific contexts. I don't really see a scenario in which a new frontal constitutional challenge could really go forward.
So if it's a choice of not being someone in a state like Texas where I am, where we don't have our own exchange, it's a choice between taking the out that the Affordable Care Act gives because insurance is unaffordable without the subsidy, and not having any insurance because I can't purchase the qualifying insurance, that just leaves me in no man's land. I cannot buy insurance because I still have to buy insurance that meets the Affordable Care Act requirements, but I can't afford to.
Well, look, it's certainly true that there are many people in that sort of situation. It, as best we can tell, a substantial percentage of the people who could lose tax credits if the plaintiffs prevail are people that had insurance that they liked and could afford prior to the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, but who lost that insurance because of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act and the way those provisions were interpreted by the Department of Health and Human Services. So it's certainly true that some of those people would suffer the consequences of the law that Congress enacted. I think there are steps that the Department of Health and Human Services could take if Congress did not act to ameliorate such concerns. I don't know whether or not this administration would be willing to take them, but for example, the administration could revise the grandfathering rules so as to make it easier for people to have the sorts of plans that they had prior to enactment of the law. There's also a waiver provision in the statute which takes effect in the year 2017, which I think states could probably take advantage of to get the benefits of the tax credit money without creating their own exchanges. You know, so there are things that states could do. There are things that the Department of Health and Human Services would do. It's not all incumbent upon Congress acting, although you know, certainly I think that people in that situation would have strong arguments to make to Congress about why Congress should act. And you know, given that the Affordable Care Act has so disrupted the health insurance sector of our economy, I would certainly hope that if the plaintiffs prevail, that Congress would take the opportunity not only to address concerns that the court decision would create, but to address the underlying concerns that are really created by the operation of the statute.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been very informative.
Sure thing.
Professor Adler, let me put you on the spot. We have a late question here from a final caller. Do you have time to take one more question?
Sure.
Okay. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy with Committee for Justice. Jonathan, thanks for a great wrap-up of today's argument. I was wondering, was there any discussion of the impact on the employer mandate and the individual mandate? Certainly all the press has been on the subsidies, but if I understand correctly, the employer mandate would fall as well, and for some people, the individual mandate would fall. Is that correct, and was there any discussion of that?
There was a little bit of discussion. So just to clarify for folks who aren't aware, the penalties that are used to enforce the employer mandate are triggered by an employee being eligible for tax credits. So if there are no tax credits in federal exchanges, then employers in states that have federal exchanges would not be subject to the employer mandate penalty. My co-author Michael Cannon had a piece in USA Today, I think it was yesterday or today, pointing out that there are quite a few victims of that. That is, people who lost hours and lost income as a result of the employer mandate, and that those are people that would be helped by a decision in favor of the plaintiffs. In addition, the incidence of the individual mandate penalty is a function of the out-of-pocket cost of purchasing insurance, and so the availability of tax credits exposes more people to the individual mandate penalty than would be exposed absent those tax credits. There was relatively little discussion of that. It came up once in terms of, well, you know, wouldn't this just make the law inoperable? And the response to that was, well, no, it just made created a choice. And in fact, if we're concerned about state autonomy, then it's certainly better to give states a choice about whether or not these sorts of provisions have effect in their states rather than to simply impose them across the board. And then there was some discussion about whether or not it would be anomalous for employers that have employees in different states to be subject to the employer mandate as a result of some employees but not the other. But that line of questioning did not seem to get too much traction, and I don't think would control the outcome.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Well, terrific call, Professor Adler. I know you're reluctant to make a prediction on the outcome, but would you agree that this is a case likely to be decided on the final day of the term? And as you say that, let me give you a chance to express any final thoughts you have before we wrap up.
Sure. This is a highly watched and anticipated case. Certainly, I'm willing to predict that it will not be unanimous. However it comes out, there will be more than two dissents or more than two dissenting justices. And I think it's certainly fair to think that this will be one of those decisions that comes out in late June, if not the final day, then maybe the penultimate day or the day before that, but certainly in that last week of opinions. And again, while I'm reluctant to make predictions, I do think that today's argument did indicate that the federal government's pure textualist arguments will have a very hard time commanding a majority, and that if the federal government wins, it is likely to be because one or two justices believe that federalism concerns justify departing from the plain text of the statute or reinterpreting the plain text of the statute. And that's really the question, is whether or not those justices think that the text of the statute is enough, or whether they think they need to modify what the statute means to account for these federalism concerns. And again, we won't know the answer to that until the end of June.
Well, terrific call, Professor Adler. Let me thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society. We will certainly welcome you back when we do have a decision. I'd love to hear your insights and analysis at that point in time. But thank you in particular for your time today. And thanks, of course, for attending oral argument and giving us the benefit of your views. To our audience, thank you as well. A lot of you on the line, thank you for your questions and your thoughtful engagement. A reminder that our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m. when we'll be looking at another Supreme Court case. This one's already decided, Yates versus U.S. It's the Sarbanes-Oxley tangible object fish case. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.